be aware, like be conscious.
Be the ball. Welcome back to the Wild Business Growth Podcast. This is your place to hear from a new entrepreneur every single Wednesday morning who's turning wild ideas into wild growth. I'm your host, Max Brandstetter, founder and podcast producer at Max Podcasting. And you can email me at max@maxpodcasting.com to save time with your high quality podcast. And if you were tuning into this on the day that it is released, then it is my birthday. And if you're tuning in on a different day, it is not my birthday. You win some, you lose some. This is episode 277, and today's guest is Andy Hunter. Andy is the founder and CEO of Bookshop.org, the super cool, super positive online book marketplace who has raised, at the time of this recording, over $30 million for local bookstores. They are a certified B Corporation. They are, of course, direct competitors with Amazon. You probably haven't heard of them. And in this episode, we talk all those things, how your approach to running your business needs to change in year one versus year four versus year beyond, Andy's family project to find the best flavors of ice cream, and everything from telepathy to why people honk their horns way too damn much. It is Mr. Prompt, or maybe I'm Mr. Prompt. Enjoy the show. Alrighty, we are here with Andy Hunter, the founder and CEO of Bookshop.org, a company doing really, 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 really cool things. I'm going to set a record for really already for local bookshops and beyond. Andy, thank you so much for joining. How are you doing today?
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Of course. Of course. We're going to get into the world of bookshops, but more specifically with books. I just want to start off, you know, coming out hot right away. I heard a quote from you where you said that books saved your life. Can you shed some light on that?
You know, I was always a reader growing up, but I also had a kind of a rough childhood. At a certain point, my mom became extremely mentally ill and my dad left and moved across the country. And so it was me and my brothers living with a mentally ill mom that we basically had to care for. And at the time I was like 11 years old, even before that, it hadn't been perfect, you know? And so I was like extremely socially awkward. You know, I didn't have decent clothes. I didn't have great hygiene. I hate to say it, but I wasn't a big fan of showers and there was nobody there to tell me to take one. I couldn't really connect with my peers very well. You know, I was bullied and kind of an outcast. And what I found in books during that time period, which lasted into my teens, was, you know, soulless company and also a real greater understanding of myself and my place in the world, what was possible. You know, and it gave me hope and it built my empathy and understanding and really just kind of kept me alive and kept me wanting to get up in the morning and kept me excited about what life could be. And so when I say the books saved my life, I really do mean it. Like there was a time for at least 5 or 6 years in my childhood where without books, I don't know what I would have done. In some ways, books like taught me how to get out of it too. Like they taught me how to cope and they still do. Like even after that, books broaden my perspective all the time and they help me understand humanity and my place in humanity and like what I want to do and why I want to do it. And they give you wisdom and they make like a lot, life a lot more interesting, you know? And I think that they're good for human society. Like I think that if you look at the printing press and you look at what happened like pre-books versus post-books, like books have been instrumental in just kind of pushing human evolution forward.
Yeah, I'm right there with you and appreciate you sharing all that. You know, it's never fun when you're in a situation growing up where you have, you know, you're going through those emotions and in a tough environment where you know, you feel like there's no hope there. And it's really uplifting that books became such an influential part of your life. And I'm sure there's no way back then you would have seen and, you know, flash forward and be like, I'm going to start a company and website that helps out lots of, you know, bookshops around the US and world. But there is something so powerful about just sitting down with a really, really good book. To this day, like, what is it about discovering a new book, having it in your hands, that just kind of leaves an impact on you?
Well, I think it's like the closest thing that we have to, I don't know, like telepathy. You can immerse yourself in the mind of another person. You can immerse yourself in a world that is completely fabricated, or in a world that is just hundreds of years ago in history. Like if you read Flaubert or Balzac, you can go back hundreds of years and learn so much about what people were like and all that. And, or if you're interested in like relativity, I mean, I learned so much from reading the physicist Brian Greene's books, and I learned so much about neuroscience by reading books like The Brain That Changes Itself, like everything. Because if you listen, like if you're just reading a short thing on the internet, or if you just watch a YouTube video or whatever, you can't get the kind of sustained logical building upon one piece, building upon another, building upon another. And it's all happening completely in your mind. So like you're shaping it too, you're creating it. And the fact that you're creating it based on these like tiny little symbols on a piece of paper is like completely insane. That you can, that we have this way to transfer thought, personality, and knowledge across time, across different people's minds is truly extraordinary. And there's nothing like it anywhere else.
So we started talking about books and we're already on to telepathy. So I appreciate the ingenuity there. Let's get to bookshop.org. So obviously from an early age, you found a home really in books and you found a passion for books, maybe telepathy as well. That's a story for another episode. But what was the turning point for you when you first thought that, hey, I could start some sort of a business or mission or like something out there to support local bookstores?
Yeah, it happened really gradually. I mean, going back to when I was a kid, I wanted to own a bookstore. Like my dream life was to have a dog and a bookstore and sleep in the back room. Like that's all I wanted to do. My ambitions expanded since then. I had done work like in IT. I had done business systems. I learned accounting. I learned how to write software. I was also interested in writing. I got an MFA in creative writing. I was interested in editorial. I became editor-chief of a magazine, and then I started working in books. I eventually was an independent book publisher. So I had done all of these different things, and I was really interested in books. And when I started working in the book world around 2009, I started watching as Amazon was growing and growing and growing. And in the beginning, you know, it was 5%, then it was 15% of the market. And like, this is going to be something really powerful. And there needs to, I had thought at the time, there needs to be something independent that counteracts its weight, that actually like has more of the values of the book community at heart. So I tried in 2011 to get a bunch of charitable foundations to create like a nonprofit alternative book ecosystem, because at the time I think Amazon had just bought Goodreads, and between Amazon and Goodreads, I'm like, these guys are going to like control everything around books if we don't watch out. Nobody was interested. In 2011, nobody was worried. Nobody cared. Like that idea completely died. And then 8 years later, Amazon had been growing 6 to 8% year over year. E-commerce was growing like 15% year over year. Amazon had over 50% of the book market. It was 2019. And at that point, like, okay, nobody has done this and nobody's going to do it. So I'll try to do it. And I put together a plan and started the long and difficult road of like fundraising and building alliances and trying to get people to back it, which was not easy. If you tell people that your business is competing directly with Amazon, most people are like, oh yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, I think that's something that I imagine most people wonder about when they first hear about your business, is like, oh my God, like these people are going right at the, as you've said before, at the Death Star at Amazon. So what were some of those reactions from potential investors when you said that, yeah, we're going to go at this company that's taking over the world?
It was almost all no's. It was like the loneliest and most isolating time that I've had in my professional career, because I would just go to meeting after meeting. And I'm probably not that good at pitching. So maybe that's part of it. But it's also part of it is that even if it succeeds, its purpose is to help strengthen independent bookstores. So it's not a 10x or 100x scenario. Like if we're hugely successful and have tons of profits, those profits are supposed to go to support local businesses, not support the investors. So that was tricky. But the real tricky part was that people were just like, the American consumer only cares about speed and price. And if you can't beat Amazon on speed, you can't beat them on price, then you're dead in the water. And I had several investors bow out, basically that kind of rationale. In the end, I was able to convince some people in book publishing that it was worth taking a flyer, and then a few kind of high net worth individuals who loved books, had either written books or were deeply connected, and I raised about half of the money I wanted to raise. I only wanted to raise $1.2 million, and I only raised $700,000. And $700,000 to try to create an e-commerce marketplace that beats Amazon at selling books is not a lot of money. But eventually I was like, we just want to build this thing. So even though I don't have as much raise as I want, and we're not going to have the runway I wanted, we're just going to start building.
Yeah, I mean, 700K is nothing to scoff at, but when you're considered the rather large competitor in the space, among other competitors, I could see how it feels pretty dwarfed by that. You know, you have the strong mission there, like you have that passion of wanting to support local bookstores. How did you start to put the pieces together of like what this would actually look like, to the point of like people are going through us to find books and find bookstores, but like how do we make sure everybody gets, you know, their share and that this mission comes to life?
You'd kind of bring the stakeholders on board from the beginning. That was kind of my plan for both, like how we actually make an impact in these people's businesses, but also how we grow. Because we didn't have money to spend on big direct-to-consumer marketing campaigns and buy Facebook ads and Google ads and that kind of thing. So we needed everybody to be behind it. So we went to conferences, we went to individual bookstores. We tried to get influential booksellers on our board of directors. We had to prove to them that we had their interest at heart. We put in our bylaws that we weren't going to sell to Amazon. And so it's in our shareholder agreement. So even if Amazon tries to buy us out, it can't happen. And once we had the booksellers on board, we expanded to other kind of types of affiliates and groups like literary magazines, nonprofits, librarians, like everybody that's in the book world. We wanted them to have pages on Bookshop. And the way Bookshop works is like, it's sort of like social e-commerce. Like any individual or organization can create their own page and curate books and promote books and receive a portion of the money from their sale. It was really building all that network. And that's what really helped us launch, because instead of just having us saying, hey, pay attention to us, we're trying to do this thing, We launched with over 250 partners that were all on Bookshop, and they were all promoting their pages too.
What were those early days like of, you know, starting to see the, I guess, I don't know if you consider it revenue or contributions, but like the money raised towards the local bookstores, like what did that look like in the early days? And like, how long did it take till it felt like it really started to pick up?
Yeah, well, luckily, like our trough of despair or whatever they call that, like if you see that, that's a popular like startup graph that shows like you launch and you're excited, and then it sinks and you go through this trough of despair.
Usually very short lived and a very long trough.
Yeah, our trough of despair was not very long. We did sort of have one. I mean, we launched, I didn't have huge expectations because I was going with the launch with an MVP. If you're not embarrassed by what you launch with, you launch too late kind of idea. So when we launched, we didn't have shipping notifications even. There was so much that we still needed to build. And then, you know, we had some people who were skeptical. We made the decision to put the amount of money that we had earned for bookstores on our homepage and in a top banner across all the pages of our site. So I was inspired by places like GoFundMe because I think that that's motivating, and it's amazing to see that your purchase makes a contribution. You actually made a difference when you buy something, and I think that's great positive feedback. But it also meant that anybody who wanted to check exactly how we were doing could come and see exactly how many books we sold and exactly how much money we had earned. And in the beginning, those numbers were not very big. So we did have some people on podcasts saying like, oh, this isn't working out. Like after a month after we launched, it's like, give us more than a month.
Sorry about that. I just couldn't wait to, trash your company.
Yeah, exactly. 2 weeks after that, COVID hit. And once COVID hit, all these bookstores had to literally go on lockdown. They couldn't even have their employees come in to fill in online orders because they couldn't put their employees at risk. Everybody was sheltering at home. They couldn't do curbside pickup in the beginning. The only way they could sell books is by selling online. And we went from having 250 stores to having 1,200 stores. And we went from selling $50,000 worth of books in February of 2020 to selling $150,000 worth of books a day by May. In July, we sold $12 million worth of books. In February, we had 4 employees, including me, and I had a day job. And by July, we were doing $12 million in a month and fulfilling thousands and thousands of orders. And it was the craziest experience of growth. Like, speaking of max growth, that was a lot of growth very fast.
Oh my God. Yeah, that is a, as if there wasn't enough going on in the world. That's a wild ride and change of, change of scenery there and change of how podcasters can talk about your company in the early days there. But that's just an incredible growth.
There was actually a guy that said he was going to eat his shoe if it succeeded. And I haven't seen him to actually ask him to eat his shoe. I let it go.
Let's hope there's no footage of that. From day one, did you set it up as a B Corp?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to go through a rigorous audit to become a B Corp. So we set up as a benefit corporation, which is basically saying the purpose of this company is for social good. And then we went through B Labs, which is the organization that vets B Corps. We started their process of validating that we were ethical, that we had good internal practices, that we were making a positive impact on the world, that we had a low environmental footprint and all of that. And that took about a year and a half. But not only did we get certified, but we got certified as one of the best for the world B Corps, which meant we scored in the top 5% of all B Corps nationwide. So we were super proud of that.
Wow. Yeah, and you should be. And congrats on that. And it's so funny that a company whose mission is to support local bookstores is being questioned on its ethics. You think that would be a no-brainer.
The industry has been burned before. And honestly, I don't think it's unreasonable for someone to be skeptical. There's a lot of brands trying to sell that they're socially conscious or eco-friendly, where if you peel back a few layers, it's more of a marketing gimmick. And for bookstores, they had seen, most people don't know this, but Borders Books, which used to be this huge chain, made an agreement that Amazon was going to do all their online ordering fulfillment. And Amazon was like, oh yeah, we understand the internet. We're going to help you sell books on the internet. And then 5 years later, Amazon had driven Borders completely out of business. So independent bookstores had seen things like that happen before. And they're like, is this going to be a rug pull? And I think that they're right to be wary. Restaurants have seen rug pulls, sites like Grubhub that used to be very, very good for restaurants now are at best a love-hate relationship because the costs, once you have full buy-in, then the costs go up. The reason that we've got booksellers on our board of directors and the reason that we are B Corp and all that is because we really want to make sure that that never happens, that we're always fulfilling our mission.
That Borders story hits close to home. I think growing up in my hometown, our bigger bookstore, I guess, was Borders. And I had never thought about it too much, but looking back, it was pretty popular. And then it just seemed like it closed overnight one time and that was it. And I think you revealed, what was going on there in the greater business and Amazon world, but it's can be such a cutthroat industry when you have competitors like that, even though it is something that is like all focused on books, which is such a positive and like optimistic and stress relieving thing. Like it's a really interesting industry dynamic there. You know, like, so you had that, we'll call it, you know, you were talking about the trough of despair. Then you had the, like, the opposite. You had, like, the hot streak in 2020 and, you know, where your monthly revenue is now what you're doing in, like, you know, from breakfast to lunch. What has been the biggest driver in growing that to the level now where, like, you have, I think, recently at the time of this recording, passed the mark of $30 million you've created and raised and given back to local bookstores. So congrats on that. Like, that's an incredible milestone. What do you think has driven the continued growth of this and supporting your mission that way?
Thank you. Yeah, like, it's really omni-channel. Where there's not one thing. I mean, obviously, COVID kickstarted everything. But since we've become a more mature business, it's more... like, you can look at the different revenue streams. First of all, we've made a real effort to become linked in all different major publications. So it used to be that Amazon's affiliate program was like the only game in town, and they would pay 4.5% off of any book sale. So we created an affiliate program where we're like, okay, if you link to us, we're going to pay you 10%. And we give a matching 10% to independent bookstores. So you're helping your local businesses, and you're helping your publication at the same time. And then we got those links everywhere. So now, by now, we have links on like Time Magazine, BuzzFeed, NPR, like The Atlantic. All of these great trusted media brands are linking to us when they cover books. Sometimes they only link to us, sometimes they link to us and Amazon, but they link to us. So that's a big driver. We have now 1,900 stores, bookstores on our platform in the US and 500 in the UK. That's like 80% of the American Bookseller Association members are on our platform. So those stores are bringing customers to us every day too. And we still rely on a ton of word of mouth. Because about 80% of our profit margin goes to the stores, we still don't have a lot of money for digital advertising. We spend about 1% of our annual revenue on digital ads. And most e-commerce companies, it's closer to 5 to 10%. So we're still like big word of mouth, community building, trying to get authentic people to believe in what we're doing and be loyal to us because they're happy about their impact.
Impact is a very relevant and accurate word. You know, those are wonderful things that you're doing. And it's awesome when you see people come together. And I think that you have a mission that people just can latch onto and really get behind. On that note, what have you heard? What kind of feedback have you heard from local bookstore owners about the company and community and possibilities that you've created with bookshop.org? If I could pronounce your URL correctly.
Yeah, I'd say 95% of the booksellers are very grateful. There are many, many stores that actively try to grow sales using Bookshop. And then there are also just as many that don't do anything but just get checks from us. A lot of them are resource constrained, you know, and I think the most important thing for us is to change their mindset about online. Because if you look at online as a threat and you don't have a presence there, you don't have time, and you don't understand how it works, and you just think of it as a place where it's competing for your customers and is a danger, then you're never going to be able to like succeed in the next 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, e-commerce is growing 15% year over year. More and more people are shopping online. Even local businesses have to have an online strategy. So for us, getting the stores on board with that and telling them like, we're going to make it a lot simpler for you. We're going to do everything we can to make it easy. So even though you have no resources and, you know, you're not trained in this stuff, we're going to be able to create online sales as an important part of your profitability every year. So that has been great. And, you know, I'm about to go to a bookseller conference next week, and we're going to have a huge roundtable about how people are using it successfully. At the same time, there's a lot more we can do. We have about, you know, a little over 1% of the book market right now. Amazon is over 50%. They're probably about 60%. So we need to get more than one out of 60 customers to say like, hey, I need to buy this book. I'm going to do it in a way that supports my local businesses and keeps like these businesses in our downtowns. You know, a lot of people who love books love bookstores, and this is just about, you know, closing that circle.
Real quick on that, because I could talk about it, but it wouldn't be nearly as exciting coming from me. What does a bookstore mean to you? Like, what sort of like the vibes? Like, there's some sort of magic in bookstores, but I'd love to hear your perspective on it.
They're like sanctuaries, but they're also like gates. I mean, I'm using fantastic language, but
that is fantastic. Let's get to telepathy too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I used to read a lot of fantasy. I don't when I now that I'm kind of older, I don't read a lot of like fantasy. But
you,
as a
you
teenager,
take that
I
back.
Read a lot.
You're just wiser.
I would you know, when I was a kid, I would, anytime I went to a store, I mean, when I went to a new town or went on vacation somewhere, I would find a bookstore and I would just hunker down and read a ton, find new things. And then even as a teenager, like I was exposed to like the kind of counterculture that I was into. Like this was pre-internet, like, or the internet existed, but it wasn't what it is today. Bookstores were just incredible portals of discovery for me. And also they're staffed by people who love books as much as I do. That's what Bookshop is all about. It is like countering the algorithm approach to books, because human beings are what matter when it comes to books. Like, and people who are inspired by books and decide to dedicate their lives to them, like people who run and own bookstores, are like the salt of the earth. And they're not doing it for money, and there's not very much money in running a bookstore, right? But if you go to a bookstore, you can meet people who understand and are inspired by the power of books, and they can transfer that power over to you, and it's awesome. And no algorithm will ever be able to do that. And if you think about why you bought a book, like you usually buy it because somebody you respect tells you that you should read it, like whether it's a friend or a parent or Oprah or whoever, like you're buying a book because somebody says like, oh, you got to read this book. It's a person.
Yeah, that would be a real tragedy if people who worked at bookstores hated books. That feels like an SNL skit or something. There's just books everywhere. it's a beautiful mission and just way you have of looking at books and bookstores. And yeah, you were kind of tongue-in-cheek making fun of your language, but thinking of them as gates or portals, I think is just an awesome way to think about it, because it really unlocks something. And sometimes you read a book that's just at the right time that you need to go on a mental vacation to somewhere around the world or out of this entire universe, a different universe. So you never know what it can turn into. You truly never know. But one thing I do definitely know, and I am super excited to announce, is that Max Podcasting, my podcast production business, is a media partner for it would help if I could pronounce their name right. CEX, the Content Entrepreneur Expo. It is the premier event for content entrepreneurs, and this event is super close to my heart. One, it is created by Joe Polizzi and team. If that name sounds familiar, it's because he is the godfather of content marketing, and he also is Wild Business Growth Podcast guest back in episode number 15 and came back on for episode 100. So lots of history with the podcast in Cleveland and Go Browns, everything there. Also, the event is taking place May 5th through May 7th in my favorite city of Cleveland, Ohio. So that's May 5th through 7th, 2024. If you are interested in going, you will absolutely love it. In addition to featuring some of the best content entrepreneur speakers who will share their tips on how to become the best content entrepreneur you can be, it also is featuring the super exciting headliner this year, BJ Novak, who you might recognize from The Office, among many other cool things, but just one of the coolest people in the world. If you're interested in attending in person, you can go and save $100 off the ticket price by signing up at cex.events and using the promo code MAX100. That is MAX100. Thanks for considering, and hoping you have the best time in the world hanging out with Ryan Howard at CEX. Now, let's move on from Dunder Mifflin a little bit and switch back to the beautiful world of bookshop.org. I'd love to switch gears a little bit and dive more into you on the personal side. So you're someone who has spent, you know, a lifetime being interested in books, being interested in writing. But then this entrepreneurship thing comes along, and it's a bit different to know what, you know, the word entrepreneur is and know what entrepreneurship is versus actually doing it yourself. And so you've had some experience in kind of multiple stops of your career there, but what was the adjustment like in going from, you know, having a job, being a writer of sorts, to being like the person, like the business owner, the entrepreneur trying to get something rolling?
I always liked making things. So, you know, in college, I lived in a house that had an independent record label. And when I got out of college, I started my own little magazine. So I had this kind of entrepreneurial vibe, which was a really DIY, like do-it-yourself thing. And honestly, all of my opportunities came out of these things that I built on my own. Like, I wasn't asking for permission. I wasn't trying to get an internship at a big magazine and work my way up the ranks. I was like, I'm going to make my own magazine. And I think that is the entrepreneurial mindset. And it's extremely liberating and it's really exciting. There's nothing like the excitement of, especially when you're starting something, when you're pulling ideas together and inspiring other people and building something that didn't exist before and getting critical mass for it. It's like a great feeling. At the same time, it's like really nerve-wracking and harrowing. And a lot of entrepreneurs like will talk about how incredibly stressful it is. You have to be ready to fail. Failure, you know, happens all the time and things go wrong all the time. It doesn't have like a support network and it's very experimental. You really have to have sleepless nights and you have to be good at managing your stress and all that. And I'm pretty even keeled, but even then it's like been torture sometimes, but it's got highs and lows. And what are you going to do? Like, that's what life's all about. Like, I'm much rather have highs and lows than be bored. I was a file clerk for a year at a law firm when I was 23 and I was bored stiff. I would never want to live like that again.
I'm bored hearing you just describe that role. Torture is an interesting, but I think accurate way of looking at it as well as an entrepreneur. It's like it's a torture of love. Like if you're starting, you know, if you're running a business, if you're building a business that you're passionate about, like you don't think of it as like, oh my God, I have to spend so many hours a week working on it. Like you just do it. Like it's part of the gig. But also like there are lots and lots of sleepless nights, I'm sure, as you know, of taking much longer to fall asleep than otherwise because you're thinking of so many different aspects of the business, or like maybe you're working more on weekends than you would otherwise. Like there's a lot of sacrifices. There's a lot of torture there, as you said. How have you been able to reduce your stress levels as part of your entrepreneurial journey?
Good exercise and like good sleep hygiene is really important. And I think it's often neglected, and it was neglected by me back, you know, before I became good at it. I would like end a stressful day with a couple of beers and then get 6 hours or 5 hours of sleep. And then, you know, you're running ragged all the time. Like just having better habits has been a game changer for me. I also think just bringing in people you trust, like people, I used to read advice that says like hiring is the most important thing you can do, and getting the right hires. And like, I kind of was like, yeah, that sounds right, whatever. But I didn't think much about it. But now that I've been through this a few times, like who you have at your side is everything. And like understanding that you have people that you trust who are competent that you can share the load with is huge. So I'd say like good habits, a good support network, and, you know, trustworthy comrades in arms trying to do it with you. That's what I think is the most important.
That's a great rundown. How do you personally seek or qualify talent, like people that are going to, you know, join your mission there?
You have to identify people who are really passionate about what you're passionate about, who are like-minded, but also who are ambitious. In the startup world, you can't just be like, oh, I just want a decent life and work-life balance. I want to clock out at 5 and... in the beginning, you really got to go all in. When you're a little bit more mature, you've actually like hit product market fit, you can start worrying about balance. And when you bring in new employees, you can allow them to have that balance and all that. But in the beginning, you got to find some people who are ride or die, and also, you know, who have diverse skill sets. One of the most important things you can do is hire people who are better than you at whatever they're supposed to be doing. A lot of entrepreneurs are generalists. I'm a generalist, so I'm pretty good at writing copy, and I'm pretty good at advising people on like UI, UX design, and I'm pretty good at project management. I'm pretty good at Google Analytics. I'm pretty good at a lot of things. And in the beginning, when I'm doing everything, it's enough. But ideally, I'm going to have people who are better at all those things once I grow and I've got like a staff of 40 people. I shouldn't be doing all those things. And every person that I hire to do those things needs to be better than me at it. And I think for ego reasons, sometimes it's hard for people to get around, but it's really critical.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. It's incredibly important to like know from the get-go that there's just like a good fit with the people that you're going to work with, because you're going to spend so much time with them. And also, like, people, I think, have to have a little bit of you know, wild and crazy in them, and that entrepreneurial spirit in order to join a startup, especially in the early days like that. So you attract a really, you know, passionate breed there as well. I'm also curious on, you know, because we keep going back to like so much of your company goes back to its mission and everything with like the B Corp, and you being even so transparent on your website about like how much money, you know, you raise for local bookstores. What advice would you have for any aspiring entrepreneur out there who wants to start a business around some sort of cause or mission that they're really passionate about, and they want to be, you know, like transparent with like, all right, we're gonna set aside this much amount of profit or revenue, even with the voice crack there, to give back to, you know, X group, whatever.
The most important thing is that you connect with the people you're trying to help. You know, there needs to be a pain point. There needs to be something that's wrong that you're trying to fix, and the fix is needed. People want what you have to offer, and there's a real need for it. A lot of entrepreneurs make the mistake of doing something that's kind of cool or sounds interesting, but nobody is like dying for it to happen. So if you're sure that there's a need, then you talk to the people who have that need, and you learn from them how you can best solve their problems and work with them. And that, first of all, is like invaluable market research that you can use to build a great product, but it's also aligning internal support in whatever industry or world that you're trying to enter into, whether you're working with healthcare workers, or you're working, you know, with school teachers, or you're working with like after-school athletic programs. It doesn't matter what the vertical is. It's like you got to talk to the people who've been doing it for 20 years. They're going to tell you a lot about what they need and whether your solution is going to fit. And also, if you give them what they want, then they're going to be your biggest supporters, and they're going to help you build a grassroots, enthusiastic user base that you can grow from. So I just think identifying the key stakeholders and the people who have been in that world for a while, learning from them, and then helping them, getting them on board and getting them on your side.
Let's switch up a bit more to a section I call the unusual. So pet peeves, quirks, weird talents. This goes beyond just like through the mindset of a business owner. This is just you personally. It's always fascinating to hear. So first there, what is a weird talent you have, like a party trick or just something? It doesn't have to do with your business at all, but just something you're really good at, but has no impact on your business.
Wow. That's a really good question. If I have one talent, it's like figuring out how different things fit together that other people think are unrelated or wouldn't think to put together. That really helps with problem solving, but it also helps when you like are conceiving of a business or trying to innovate, because innovation, a lot of people think it's like invention and it's coming out of nowhere. So you have inspiration and you create something that never existed before, but that's not really what it is. What it is putting existing things together in a new way, in a way that is slightly different. That is what innovation is all about. Nothing comes from out of nowhere. Everything is built upon a history of human effort and human knowledge. And it's about how you combine the things that is what is unique about it. And that is what's going to bring it life and get it traction. And so I understand this isn't like an unusual, it's not too far afield. I wish I could think of it like I think I use everything I'm good at in my business. Honestly, like I'm bad at a lot of stuff. Like I'm terrible at sports. You know, I naturally would stay up late and like eat bad foods. I'll eat a pint of ice cream if you put it in front of me. Like I don't have great impulse control. Like I'm not good at a lot of things. The things that I'm good at, I try to put into my business.
Well, we could have a lot of fun going down the ice cream and late night sports rabbit hole, but well, I guess late night food rabbit hole. Your point on putting things together, like that is a really hell of a skill to have as an entrepreneur. And I remember going back to, you know, studying business in college, like one of the things in an entrepreneurship course, one of the things they talked about was that like, it is extremely hard, almost impossible to come up with just like a brand new, totally novel, pun intended, books, idea. It's much more feasible to take existing ideas and then combine them or put them in a new light and like add your spin on it. It's the same thing of how it works in the music world. Like some of the biggest hits always that you hear on whatever you listen to are remixed or sampled from, you know, previous hits or previous under the radar songs. Like same thing applies in the business world, music and beyond. So that's an awesome point there. How about quirks? What's something a little quirky about your personality that, and there's no shame here, that maybe your family, team, somebody calls you out for, but it's who you are. You've always been that way. There's no shame.
Because I didn't grow up with any structure, I'm not like normally like Mr. Structure or Mr. Consistency. Like I'm more like, I'll have an idea, I'll do something differently. That is something that like I really think is great and it's helped me a lot, but also sometimes it throws people off because a lot of times in the day-to-day people want consistency. Really being a parent has made me realize it, because like when you have a kid and you're walking them home from school and they're like, can I have some M&Ms? And you're like, yeah, let's have some M&Ms. Like it sounds like super fun, right? We're going to be inconsistent. We're going to randomly get you some M&Ms on the walk home from school today.
So and then
you have fun for 5 minutes. Yeah. And then the next day, it's time for M&Ms. And you're like, no, that was a special time. And then every day they're going to ask you for M&Ms. Or, you know, and when you are kind of random and inconsistent, it can throw people off and it can create problems. It can also be a great opportunity for wonderful moments of spontaneity and happiness. Like learning how to be consistent when it's required has been a big effort for me as I get older and try to run a company. It's a lot different also running a company that's 4 years old than starting a company. And 4 years old still isn't old, but you need different skills. You have to become a little bit more like reliable and consistent. And you have to understand that if you have a crazy new idea, you can't just throw it out there because it'll destabilize people. If the boss comes and says, hey, we're going to do this new thing, people can sometimes be like, what? That's crazy. We don't know how to do that. And that's a lot, sounds like a lot of work. And is that going to work out? So you got to be careful about throwing out your ideas. Just in the same way you wouldn't sit down at your dinner table and be like, what if we move to Minnesota? Like, it's going to throw your family off, even if you just think it's fun to think about. So like learning how to let ideas like mature and not throw people off and use your spontaneity carefully and provide people with the consistency that they need and structure that they need has been a big period of growth for me.
Right now, our audience in Minnesota is, you know, pounding their fists at you. But no, I love that there. And then pet peeves. What is something that is, in the grand scheme of life, very minuscule, which I can never pronounce right, very like no big impact at all. Maybe it's something around the house or just in everyday life, but it just grinds your gears a little bit.
Recently, I've been driven crazy by the way that people stand in the doorway of the subway in New York City. There will be this huge empty subway car, and then there will be like two people with backpacks on that just walk one step into the car and then stay there. And you can't get on or off the subway because they're just standing there. That drives me crazy. And I think in general, everything that kind of is like where somebody chooses to not honor the social contract because they're like lazy or obstinate, like all that kind of stuff bothers me. Because I live in New York City, it's a lot of my pet peeves are urban. Like, I wish people didn't honk their horns so freaking much.
Oh my God. I was literally, I had just interviewed an entrepreneur. His name's Bryce out of North Dakota. And we talked about horn honking. He said in North Dakota, everyone's so nice and friendly there that no one honks their horn ever. And I'm like, in the New York area, I said, like, I want to ban horns, like, except for emergency situations. It is the most annoying thing.
That would be my legislation that would make me deeply unpopular if I became president or whatever. Well,
especially in Minnesota. You wouldn't get the Minnesota vote.
I think everybody should be allowed to use their horn like 5 times a month. And then after that, there should be like a $20 charge.
That's awesome. The horn fee. Well, Mr. Structure, Mr. Consistency, let's wrap up with some rapid-fire Q&A. You ready for it?
Sure.
All right, let's get wild. Don't get too excited there. I know you studied creative writing. Or what was the most fun creative writing exercise that comes to mind?
The most fun I've ever had writing was to write like a long personal ad. I'm not like Mr. Prompt or creative writing exercises. I am trying to write a book, but writing a personal ad in a fictional voice, that was fun. And it allows you to, you know, you can layer a lot of things in there. And I like writing things that are funny. So there's a lot of room for making jokes in fake personal ads.
Well, I already called you Mr. Structure and Mr. Consistency. Now you're making me throw Mr. Prompt in there as well. So this is like... Yeah, I don't know. Mr. and Mrs. Smith here. I don't know.
You prompted me. I think you're Mr. Prompt.
Appreciate it, Mr. Prompt. Oh, boy. That's quite the nickname. I know also earlier in your career, you worked on Lollapalooza magazine. So really, really cool stuff with Lollapalooza. Just to confirm, is that tied to the concert or was that totally separate?
Oh, yeah. That was a tour publication. I worked with Perry Farrell, who created... the Lollapalooza tour.
Jane's Addiction.
Used to work out of his house. Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Which he lived in this converted airplane hangar, and he had a koi pond and a stream running through its entire length. So it was like basically a babbling brook and a koi pond in his house. It was really cool. And working with him was great.
What's the most memorable moment or quick story you have from working with him?
I don't know if I can talk about them. I mean, I was friends with a lot of musicians. What I loved about that, like in LA in my 20s, was I was just really allowed to like interact with all of these legendary people, meeting and hanging out with people who like had inspired me when I was a teenager, listening to their records. Those were the greatest moments. And that's really why I was interested in that job. But things would get pretty wild in that world. I think that probably everybody is like sober now. But back in the day, things were pretty crazy.
I was fortunate to see Jane's Addiction at Gravity Games in Cleveland back in the early 2000s, which was like the bizarro X Games. And it just blew my mind, and still I love Jane's Addiction to this day, and everything there is, I mean, Lala obviously now in Chicago has like taken on a life of its own, but that's really, really cool. You got to step into that world there. I'm sure, yeah, we can talk for hours and hours, maybe offline about more stories from that, but all right. What is the just most intriguing book cover that you've ever seen? I know you can't pick your favorite children, but just in you know, they say you can't judge a book by its cover, but what's a cover that you think is really clever and creative?
God, I needed that question in advance. I would
Well, they don't call me Mr. Prompt for nothing.
Yeah. I think McSweeney's, which is a magazine and a press coming out of San Francisco, generally are the most innovative in their designs. And they do all kinds of like super interesting stuff with their covers.
And then last one, what is the most mouth-watering, delicious, bingeable ice cream flavor that you have ever tasted?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. That's something that me and my 12-year-old daughter are on a constant quest to discover.
That's a fun research project, family project.
Yeah. I mean, right now I'm liking Van Llewellyn, which is a local New York brand. I think it's getting more and more popular. Currently, I guess I'm a fan of their honeycomb. From my childhood, I love malted vanilla, which is almost impossible to find as an ice cream. But I used to get malted vanilla milkshakes when I was a kid, and I loved them. Like that and the grilled cheese was like my favorite thing. And so since then, I've always been on the quest for like the best malted vanilla ice cream or milkshakes. And they're kind of rare. And I think Tillamook is the only ice cream manufacturer that still makes malted vanilla you can buy in stores, but I can't find it in New York.
Ooh, that's a wonderful throwback. Yeah, I think that growing up, my dad, like one of his guilty pleasures was, you know, if you go to like a diner or like, you know, Steak and Shake type style place, Johnny Rockets like that, was to get like a giant malt. And yeah. I didn't know what it was at first. And then I tasted it. I was like, that's pretty damn good. I see why you like this. Well, the anti-Mr. Prompt. No, I'm just kidding. Andy, thank you so much. This has been an absolute blast. Just love everything you're doing and so inspiring to see and hear your growth story. Thank you so much for coming on. Obviously, bookshop.org, it's pretty, you know, intuitive how to find bookshop.org. But is there a place that if people wanted to connect with you online or just anything else you want to shout out?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn. My email is andy@bookshop.org. So just yeah, people can feel free to reach out to me. I love hearing from people. I love collaborating.
Perfect. And then maybe if you're lucky, Andy, someone will send you the best malt in the world. I don't even know where to find it. Maybe we'll head up Tillamook, but no. But last thing, final thoughts. It could be just a quote, words to live by, whatever you want. Send us home here.
Be aware, like be conscious. So much of people's day-to-day lives, they're not really, they're like in a half slumber. I think it's really important to kind of wake up almost as if you had amnesia and you're like, where am I? What am I doing here? Like it's really important to go through an exercise like that at least once a month. Just like, what am I feeling? Like, what's my environment? Really be there. It's kind of like mindfulness, but not just mindfulness, because it's also like putting your life in perspective and making sure that you're like doing the right things, breaking out of the day-to-day and like trying to view things from a little bit of perspective. So if you've got like that point of view camera, just taking the point of view camera and making it a little bit above you so you can see yourself in your perspective and figure out like, what am I doing here? That's my words of wisdom, is to do that regularly.
Great insight from the wonderful bookshop.org man. Thank you so much, Andy, for all you do for local bookstores, for all you do in general, and for coming on the podcast and sharing your story with us today. And thank you, Wild listeners, for tuning in to another episode. If you want to hear more wild stories like this one, make sure to subscribe or follow the Wild Business Growth Podcast on your favorite podcast platform. If you're interested in the video option, we are launching more and more videos on YouTube as well. That's YouTube at Max Brandstetter. And you can also find us on Good Pods, where there are good podcast recommendations. Also, for any help with podcast production, you can learn more at maxpodcasting.com. And to sign up for the Podcasting to the Max newsletter, where podcasting meets entrepreneurship and the worst puns on earth, in maybe even in outer space as well, you can sign up at maxpodcasting.com/newsletter. Until next time, let your business run wild.
Bring on the bongos!